Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month of July by the Justice Brothers. Back from the Red Bull Ring, but enjoying a little bit of family time, is our co-pilot, Graham Goodwin.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Week in Sports Cars. Yes, a little bit of R&R, so if you do hear either horses neighing or the local cockerel crowing, that's just been my soundtrack for the last couple of days, and what a glorious thing that is.
Good man. So on the docket today, tonight, we're recording a little bit later than usual, but that is entirely my fault. We have IMSA at Lime Rock, which was a corker of a race, with the first of two GT-only events of the year. We have the Red Bull Ring, where Graham was last weekend with the ELMS. We've got some 24-hour racing coming up this weekend in Spa-Francorchamps, and we have a whole bunch of great questions. So I'm on a little bit of a compressed schedule, Mr. Goodwin. I've got to be out of here early in the morning, fly to Mid-Ohio for the IndyCar weekend, then staying over in the Midwest and driving up to Road America for the next IMSA round. In between, I'm hoping to stop by and say hi to Mazda's John Doonan in his office in Illinois, and also maybe to stop by and see good old Bobby Ray Hall in his little man cave there. So slightly busy times ahead, so might try and make this a little bit more of a compact episode. We'll probably avoid splitting it into separate discussion and Q&A just because the length might not warrant it. So with all that said, as we mentioned in the open, Graham, ongoing thanks to Justice Brothers for their coming on board to help us here in July. We'll be back right after this.
This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com.
All right, Mr. Goodwin, we are going to lead off with your world in the ELMS. There's also a little bit of Asian Le Mans Series news I know you wanted to talk about. And I have to raise my hand and say that while I try and keep tabs on everything happening in the world of motor racing, I'm having to rely on you pretty heavily here to tell me what I missed, by and large, last weekend in Europe.
Completely understandable. We've got multiple race meetings every weekend, really, haven't we, at the moment in our world? And you've got the IndyCar world on top of that. European Le Mans Series, Red Bull Ring, fabulous part of the world in the Styrian Mountains. Beautiful surroundings for that. 42 cars on the main card, 26 cars with the associated Michelin Le Mans Cup. Huge numbers of sports prototypes, fabulous looking, fabulous sounding racing, and a pretty good race. Reducing ourselves to comments about the ELMS, pretty good race in LMP2, albeit affected once again post-race by some more stewards' decisions. Come to that in a moment. LMP3, an absolute corker. Wonderful stuff from a couple of British teams finishing 1-2. Polish team finishing third. And a common factor between the second and third place cars we'll come to in a mo. GTE, maybe not quite so thrilling, but a second win in a row for the Proton competition squad after Le Mans with Christian Reed et al., the sister car, the 88 car, taking the win there. But for most people, I think that keeping an eye on the headlines, it's going to be about one of the dominant cars in the race, Duquesne Engineering, newcomer to LMP2 this season, by dint of the fact that the company behind Duquesne Engineering has taken control of the Norma LMP3 program. They're now building those cars. They don't want to race directly against their customers. It was previously an LMP3 effort from Duquesne, so they've moved on up to LMP2, and a very effective job they are doing. Should have won it. didn't win it. That race win went by dint of a little bit of luck and some very good strategy to, somewhat ironically, the TDS Racing G-Drive racing team. Started the weekend, MP, with news that the Le Mans disqualification to do with change made to a fuel rig. Number one, we heard that a clarification has been issued that backs up effectively what the steward's decision was, that you are not allowed to place a device in to defeat the fuel fill restrictor. Number two, that the appeal by G-Drive against that disqualification will not be heard by the FIA Court of Appeal until September. We will not have a final confirmed result of LMP2, fifth place overall, and the winners of LMP2, the Le Mans 24 Hours 2018, until September this year. That said, we got a completely different sort of fuel controversy post-race in Austria. Duquesne Engineering came home second, great race to the flag with the Racing Engineering squad. And then late in the evening, we heard problems, a contaminated fuel sample. The explanation has been given by the team. It's all to do with two pretty similar fuels, one being used in testing by an associated LMP3 team. They clearly didn't flush out the rig properly, and they've lost that second place because the fuel was not compliant. Something like half of 1% of the fuel sample was a different brand of fuel. It was ELF rather than Total 102. So, again, slightly bitter taste in the mouth after a great race weekend to lose a podium sitter in that way. For me, the bigger story is, you know, this Court of Appeal thing. It's just going to drag on and on. Should say, TDS very bullish, believing that their case is pretty solid. The opposite side, the powers that be, making it very clear indeed they don't agree at all, and that they believe the current result, provisional result, with Signatec Alpine in the pound seats and the TDS G-Drive racing team disqualified, will remain off the Court of Appeal. We will see.
Sports car racing, courts of appeals, you did bad things, go away, points, here you go, points, give them back. Yeah, that's kind of been the norm.
Should say though, MP, one. I wouldn't want people to go away thinking that was the tone across the weekend, because it wasn't. The tone across the weekend, very positive, up and down the European Le Mans Series paddock. Number of teams not currently in LMP2 that I expect to be in LMP2 next year. At least one other that's run one car in LMP2, looking set to run a second car next year, and I think it might be more than one. But for me, the biggest surprise across the European Le Mans Series and Michelin Le Mans Cup grids is the number of teams that are looking very, very closely at adding an Asian Le Mans Series program to their current European program. It's a fairly short series in the LMS, just six races, the same for Michelin Le Mans Cup. It's a fairly short series for the Asian Le Mans Series, just four meetings there. And as things stand, after a poor year in terms of numbers in Asia last season, of course, it's a winter season there. At the moment, what I'm tracking, it's already passed doubling of those numbers.
Wow.
And it's heading on up. So fingers crossed, we're looking towards a grid that could hit 20 prototypes between LMP2. Of course, it's still the old school Nissan and Judd V8 engine cars.
But that's brilliant though. This is the kind of thing Cyril and the folks in charge of the series have been dreaming of, that kind of thing. And you know, admittedly, there was a lot of hype about the formation of the Asian Le Mans Series and a lot of hope that it would become something, but it did kind of sit a little bit stagnant there for many years. So if we're talking about that kind of growth in such a short amount of time here, I mean, that is truly staggering.
It is, and well deserved. It's a small but perfectly formed team, some very familiar faces to anybody that operates in the paddocks for the WEC, the LMS. We have had Wilder Freitas as the race director there. Thoroughly enjoyable race weekends. I'll put my hand up and say, yes, I'm part of the team and do the TV commentary and some other duties for the Asia Le Mans series. But it does my heart good that good people have been rewarded for good planning with good teams going. So far, amongst the teams we know that are going, United Autosports have confirmed four cars, two LMP2, two LMP3. The Inter-Europol team that took a fine podium finish this last weekend, so a Polish team but operated by a German service provider, they're looking to put two cars out. Ikuriakos Nielsen, one of the standout teams last year in the junior championships and stepping forward two second places this weekend and both fighting efforts as well. They're looking to put two cars on the grid. It's coming together, and what it means is we've got a pretty seamless season coming together for some of these teams, moving from Europe to Asia, and they hope back to Europe and back to the Le Mans 24 Hours, because for very many of them, of course, it is about attracting the attention of the ACO when we come around to February and those entry lists are put together.
Graham, let's jump into some IMSA at Lime Rock Park, where we had both the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship and Continental Tire Series in action. And after that, after getting through the race news and such, we have two folks, respective titans of their portion of the industry that we're having a bid farewell to, unfortunately. IMSA. Wow. I'll just say that. I don't know how we spell that. I don't know how many O's are involved, but wow. If you tuned in to the Northeast Grand Prix, the start of the Northeast Grand Prix, Graham, you would have been fairly convinced that Antonio Garcia and Jan Magnussen were off to a good old romp. Race was going to be theirs overall for Corvette Racing on IMSA's first GT-only weekend of the year. And if that's all you did, if you checked out, even with, I don't know, 10 minutes to go, and saw them still leading from pole, again, you probably would have been convinced, nothing else here to watch, nothing's going on. And then something went on. Rarely do we see someone like Jan Magnussen make the kind of mistake that he did. All in, I would say, good faith, Graham. It wasn't like he just made a truly bonehead move. Coming down the hill onto the quick right-hander onto the front straight, trying to put some lapped GT Daytona traffic between himself and Joey Hand, who was pursuing closely in second place, was able to do that, get by the first main car he was going after. Had to go to the inside of the track, though, my friend. Got on to the dirty line while also carrying a little bit too much speed. And by the time he started around towards the apex, that combination of high speed and the less optimal line pushed that Corvette C7R out onto the marbles, understeered into the dirt and grass, and watched as Joey Hand drove by. Without that gaffe, Graham, I don't know if Joey would have gotten him. It was shaping up to be a heck of a finish, but I can tell you that the Ford Chip Ganassi Racing team, completely elated, also had the look of like, oh, well, thanks for the gift. We weren't exactly expecting that one. So, yeah, you feel bad for a team like Corvette Racing that's put in a stupendous weekend of work and came so close to victory just in the last, I think, whatever it was, 8 minutes, 9 minutes, something like that, to see it all go away. At the same time, that's one of those things that keeps us coming back to motor racing, because you can't say it's 100% predictable. You cannot say that everything went according to plan. You had that big twist at the end. Some sorrow on one end. On the other side, the folks at IMSA must have been smiling, saying, "Woo, we sent folks home with something to talk about." And the WeatherTech side, Graham, was not the only fun of the weekend preceding the WeatherTech race. We had the Conti series, where talk about, I would say, almost an even bigger surprise. We had overall win first by Team TGM, which is great. They have grown quickly in this space in the Conti series with their GT4 spec Mercedes AMGs. So not only good on them, that was, again, you know, truly, truly something that they will not be forgetting any time soon. It's one of the happiest wins I can recall seeing in IMSA this year for the team, whether it's team owner Ted Giovannis, Owen Twinkler, Graham. What the fuck is wrong with me today? I wish I could keep all this stuff in. I mean... Owen Twinkler.
That's a good one.
I'm just going to start over again. I mean, the hell with it. And Graham, I'm telling you, the fun did not stop on the WeatherTech side. I keep trying not to call him Owen Twinkler, but Owen Trinkler, Ted Giovannis, Hugh Plum, the entire Team TGM effort, getting their first win overall in the Conti series in the GS category with their GT4 spec Mercedes AMG GT4s. Possibly the happiest first race winners I have seen in quite some time in IMSA. And then we had the result in TCR with Michael Johnson, been paralyzed since the age of 12, getting JDC Miller Motorsports' first win in their Audi RS3 LMS TCR entry. He and the superb Steven Simpson beating Kenton Cook to the line by about 0.0000 millionth of a second. Truly a finish, photo finish event for them. Big, big news as well for Michael, being the first paralyzed race car driver I can think of to have won a professional race here in North America. Not saying, you know, if I've missed out on something in the past, then that's my ignorance, but just a weekend of celebration for the quality of production-based racing, a weekend of celebration for someone like Michael, who has stuck with his career after two really serious crashes, bone-breaking crashes. Fortunately for him, he could not feel them when those took place in the past, but it was still huge trauma to his body. He has persisted. The JDC Miller team, as you recall, rode off a car with that second crash that he had at the Roar. They've come back from a lot, so for them to win their first in IMSA Continental Edition, fantastic for them. Take the Team TGM win as well. Pair of first-time winners there. Take the, holy cow, GTLM win by Ford. And then you back it up with, you know, the third, I would say, really stupendous result, my friend, in the Paul Miller Racing Team comprehensively blowing a motor on Friday, a fire at the back of the car, missing approximately half of the day, while having to change an engine, get the car ready, show up, qualify well, qualify fourth, and then from about halfway on in the race, just struck, just moved forward, got into the lead. Brian Sellers, holy cow. I'm not looking for him to leave Paul Miller Racing at any point in time, Graham, but I will say that as someone who was once a part of the GTLM class with the Falcon Porsche team, this is a guy whose talent, like many, honestly, many of the lead drivers in GTD, his drive last weekend to get Paul Miller Racing into victory lane again to extend their championship lead, further reminder that if there is a GTLM seat open in the future, he needs to be among the first considered. And then you close that out with his younger teammate, Madison Snow, who I would say his performance just as impressive, knowing that he is not the lead driver and yet build added to that lead and just truly overturned big adversity for them. So many headlines there, Graham. So many things to celebrate. IMSA, at least as I saw it, came away from Lime Rock with nothing but victories as an overall organization. Oh, no post-race disqualifications that come to mind either.
Absolutely. Well, I can tell you, I did see the end of the ATSC race. Phenomenal stuff. Absolutely phenomenal stuff in both major classes, and a delight to see that that race result. For IMSA, for me, you know, I was across most recently, of course, at Watkins Glen. Fantastic weekend of racing. I came away from that MP with one worry, and one worry only. And that was, for me, for my my taste, just too much contact that was not penalised. And I do worry where that actually leaves the series moving forward. It's the one thing when I watch it fairly consistently that, to my European tastes, is a surprise and a concern. Aside from that, no doubt in my mind that if you were asking me today if I would be able to choose to go and watch any racing package on the planet right now, I'd be hard-pressed between the ELMS weekend with the Michelin Le Mans Cup, which I absolutely love seeing two of the young lads in the Formula Renaults there, and the IMSA package with a fantastic supporting cast of support series and real great action at the front with the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Series itself. And the fact that they can produce that on a weekend when it's GTs only, I think, is more to the good.
We had two obituaries to write. Dave Mirage, lost in a boating accident, was out with his girlfriend Saturday night from some of the folks who are close to him and have heard directly from Inside Champion Racing. It looks like something as simple, Graham, as possibly falling off the back of his yacht while he and his girlfriend were out sailing. So was recovered Sunday morning, having drowned. So there is a funeral scheduled for Friday. Spoke with Alan McNish and Brad Kettler for a separate podcast that you might take a listen to if you either had an appreciation for Dave Mirage or just learning of him recently. A spectacular person, set incredibly high standards. One that in the relatively brief period, he was involved as a sports car entrant compared to maybe some of the those who were of his equal measure at the time, Roger Penske, Chris Dice, and some others who'd been in much longer. He really did push the entire North American sports car scene to a place it had not been in for quite some time. And then you have Champion Racing's 2005 victory at Le Mans, Graham. Again, another, the most recent high point for an overall win for a North American entrant. And altogether, between Brad and Alan sharing some thoughts with us in a dedicated podcast to the words you've written and many others who knew and had an affinity for Dave Mirage, not only sad, but also unexpected.
Yeah. I think that's perfectly put. I do commend your podcast with the boys. It's, you know, whenever anybody passes, it's always good to hear from people who knew them really well. And Brad and Alan most certainly did. That comes across very much in that. Last time I met Dave Mirage was back in 2014 at the launch of David Tremaine's epic tome on the subject of Champion Racing. And what a stellar individual. Me with my normal stumbling kind of interview style, and Dave was just an excellent individual. The people who turned out for that, there were one or two significant guys that couldn't make it, but the people that turned out for that book launch in London from all around the world. There's one shot I picked out for the DSC obituary for Dave, and 6-7 people in that shot that would be in anybody's top dozen in modern sports car racing history, as the people they might pick for 2 or 3 car squad, and all of them drove for Dave Mirage. You know, through from Porsche back in the early days, through into the Audi days and World Challenge with the epic S4 and then the S6, and then LMP. What can you say? The Audi R8. You know, the silver of Team Yerst is the iconic color scheme, but almost equaling it the champion racing colours in the Audi R8. And let's not forget as well, one of the very few effectively privateer efforts to run, you know, diesel prototypes with success. 19 titles won in the short period of time that that Champion Racing were active. And was it four consecutive driver and team titles in LMP1 in the American Le Mans Series? He is going to be missed. He's one of those guys, you know, if you follow, as I do, a lot of the online discussion sites, people still ask to this day, is it possible we might see Champion Racing come back? Sadly, I think the door is finally closed on that one. It's closed in the saddest way possible. So, you know, to Dave, I hope you're up there enjoying yourself, my friend. It's an awful way to hear that someone's passed on. And, you know, a firm part of the endurance racing family years after they finally part the cars.
And why don't you share some thoughts with us, Graham, on Sergio Marchionne, who we just learned about his passing after, yeah, again, another, good Lord. It's not as if we get a lot of notification when most people that we either respect or care about pass away, but it seems like we've had a couple of folks who didn't seem like it was their time, but alas, we were wrong.
I think Sergio Marchionne, I'll be pretty clear what's actually emerging now in terms of detail. It was allegedly surgery on his shoulder that went awry, but that would appear to be masking the issue that I think Sergio knew that the cancer he had was pretty well advanced. Embolism ended the story very, very quickly. Fiat Chrysler chief executive, and as such had some tough decisions to make about you know, some significant motorsport programs that a lot of our listeners will have either agreed or fundamentally disagreed with, but he's an excellent example of a senior, not motorsport but automotive executive dealing with the aftermath of, let's face it, a world-changing economic crisis. That did mean some tough calls around one or two programs, but no doubt in my mind he was a car guy. That's the key thing here. He's a car guy. Yes, a businessman, but a car guy, and the world needs more of those at the moment. You know, it's a terrible way to go, you know, with no real notice to those closest to him. Rest in peace as well, Sergio. And let's see what comes out of the huge organization with Fiat Chrysler Automotive that might put a smile on people's faces from a lot of brands that people hold terrifically dear.
Mr. Goodwin, should I break into song and say questions? Oh, we got questions. We get your questions every day. Where shall we start, my friend? We have many, many, many on the Facebook. We don't have a ton on the tweeters, but where would you like to kick off?
Well, let's go to Facebook. You can crack on because I'm dealing with the, as I look out of the window with a wonderful red deer just tiptoeing down past the path.
Wow.
Dear me. Have a quick look at Facebook. The Wi-Fi here is not playing quickly. You fire away and throw on my way, my friend.
Let's do that. All right. You know, let's go P1. Respect to Joseph Kang for being the first person to get a question in. I have a follow-up question from last week's episode regarding DPIs versus global P2s. If you had an all-pro lineup in a P2, do you think that team would be more competitive against the DPIs at more circuits, or do you think they would still be outgunned by the inherent advantages that the DPIs have with custom dampers, etc.? I can take that one if you want, or you can take that. That tends to be my regional championship, but we're an international show.
I'll give you my 10 penneth, and then you can crack on with rather more detail and evidence to back it up. There is a reality. It can only be closer because it could only be more speed than the current, generally speaking, Pro-Am format. But would I like to see, whether or not it's in North America or in Europe, if you like, a P2 Pro? I think the time for that in Europe has gone with the regeneration, if you like, at the moment in LMP1 non-hybrid. But would I like to see that in the States. I'm a sports car fan. Of course I'd like to see it. Whether or not that's sustainable, we'll wait and see. MP, what do you think?
Yeah, Joseph, you raise a great point. I think that with where we are right now, if IMSA were to freeze balance of performance on the DPI side, leave it as is, a pro-pro lineup in an Areca 07, I think, would be absolutely unbeatable. We're not playing favorites by mentioning the Areca. It's just that it has demonstrated clear advantage among the other spec P2s, at least recently. And then if you consider how much the DPIs have been reined in to bring the P2s forward, yeah. If John Bennett, for example, had to take Road America off and go do something else, and Core Autosport said, hey, Romain Dumas, come on back, it's going to be you and Colin Brown, I mean, I'd start writing my race report on Friday. Barring something strange happening, you could effectively write the outcome of the race before practice got underway on Friday, Graham, because you know we're at a place where, because of BOP and because of the ongoing efforts to pull DPIs back so there is that parity between the two styles of prototypes, yeah, a pro-pro lineup, especially in the Areca, whew, that would be lethal. Let's see, I'm going to go to Doug Bonham. For a non-European fan traveling in from overseas for the event, if you could only recommend one, would you recommend the Goodwood Festival of Speed or Le Mans Classic, Graham Goodwood?
Oh, great question. Great yeah. question, Doug. Well, if at all possible and you can get the time off, they're close enough, you could do both. Remember, though, the course of the Goodwood Festival of Speed is an annual event. Le Mans Classic is every 2 years. So keep that in mind and don't turn up and find that the city's incredibly quiet. For me, it depends what you want. If you want to see a fantastic blend of the most iconic, unusual, classic race cars blended with the best of the global sports car and hypercar offering for road cars, Goodwood has it. It is in effect now a historic racing festival blended with a motor show. As a family occasion, pretty faultless. Very, very busy on the weekends. The car park has to be seen to be believed. Literally fields and fields of cars. They reserve some of those car parks, the fields, for classic cars. So you are literally dealing with fields full of classic cars. Can't get a hotel close to the place for love nor an awful lot of money. That said, for me, it would be Le Mans Classic. Why? Because the cars are on track and they are racing, as well as having something like, I think, 7,000 classic cars in the various club displays around the plot. There's something like 700 or so classic cars actually racing on track. And not only that, it's one of the most classic tracks in the world, and access is as good, if not better, than for the Le Mans 24 Hours. Also, prices in Le Mans are a little bit more realistic for that weekend because, of course, the crowd is a little lower. So for me, if racing is what you want to see, for me, then it would be the Le Mans Classic. I think there's a lot to be said for both of those events. But if what you want to see is these fantastic old cars running at full tilt, the Le Mans Classic is the place to go.
Ooh, well, I have zero on my list of things that I have accomplished seeing. So I think I need to go to both.
You'd love both. You'd love both. The other one, by the way, the Goodwood Revival addresses the issue around a lack of track time, and it's a festival of motorsport. It really is a high quality, world class day out, and not ridiculously expensive either. For me, the Revival is the better option than the Festival of Speed. But if you're coming over for Le Mans Classic, do look at the dates in 2 years' time, because there's every possibility that for a reasonable amount of time, you could go to one of the early days of the Goodwood Festival of Speed and keep it to a 2 week break and bookend it with some world class historic motorsport.
I am going to jump down to some fun here, courtesy of our friend Shay Adam. Shay says, you can establish a spec series with any single car that currently runs an IMSA under the entire umbrella, not just WeatherTech. Which car model would you like to see and say 30 competitors put on track every weekend? All right, the entire thing, Graham. Keep in mind that the Mazda Global MX-5 Cup is actually under IndyCar sanction, so that has been scrubbed from the IMSA playbook at most rounds, but that does leave us, still leaves us plenty of good things from the Conti series, the little prototypes with LMP3s and whatnot. We have the Lamborghini Super Trofeos and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. What do you pick for your spec series?
I'm going to go for the Chevrolet Corvette C7R Cup.
I love it.
I think that could be quite fun. It'd certainly be noisy, wouldn't it? I mean, yeah. I mean, those or the Porsche 911 RSR. For me, the sound does it every time. Those are just two very different sounding cars, and they're just both utterly and completely fabulous. But not a massive lover of one make and spec racing. There are some great examples where it does work extraordinarily well. That or something like the kind of the Camaro or the Mustang GT4s. But for me, the quicker the better. If you're going to go one make, go one make. And I think it would be a GT rather than a prototype for me. Yeah, I'd go for that. I'd go for a big, hairy GTLM single make cup with the proviso that you can't do it unless there's at least 35 of them on track.
And you would have to alert local seismologists and others that there are no earthquakes happening when nearby. I wonder, should I reach to the past and say the All Panos Abruzzi spec series? A car that you could drive front ways, back ways, sideways, and it's equally offending to the eye? No, well, this is going to be predictable, and I feel bad. Or should I feel bad? Or should I embrace my single-mindedness? I am going to also pick from the GTLM category, as you have, but it would be the all Porsche 911 RSR class, and it would be for the sounds. But it would also be for watching the cars at some of the longer road courses, knowing that they are relatively square dimensionally, and that you would definitely have some teams that did not nail the setups. And assuming that we have some high-quality drivers in those 911 RSRs, there would be a lot of sideways moments. And so, yeah, for me, 35 of those on track, everyone would stop working. No one would work on cars. No one would be handing out food, you know, with the vendors and such. I think folks would just run up to the sides of the track and listen. So that would be my little slice of spec racing heaven. And I'm sure Porsche would also like the idea of selling 30 to 35 911 RSRs. There'd probably be a good profit margin in there. We're going to go to Kevin Frederico. He says, hey, guys, how much would it cost a privateer squad to run a DPI program? And that, Kevin, I would say is one of the proverbial how long is a piece of string questions. It could cost someone $10 million. It could cost them $4 million. It could the number is whatever a team would want it to be. I would say it would be very hard for a team running a single entry to be competitive for anything less than about $4 million. But I do know that if we're looking at the factories and what they spend, yeah, you're looking at a much larger number because we have large automotive brands doing that. But if you were to look, Graham, say at a Wayne Taylor Racing or the Action Express team with Cadillacs, also the Spirit of Daytona team, those while works affiliated and part of the GM Racing, Cadillac Racing family, that is a car sale program. That is an engine lease program, annual engine leases being paid. And I don't know their exact business model, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some form of financial assistance, whether it's direct dollars and or just R&D assistance and such. But for the most part, in Action Express, owned by IMSA founder Jim France, a lot of that budget comes out of his pocket. On the Wayne Taylor side, they have numerous long-term sponsors on the Spirit of Daytona side, which they have actually been sitting out most of the season due to a financial crunch. They too have relied on sponsors, so we can see that you're still looking at almost an IndyCar budget for one car per year, and that's not a small thing, Graham.
No, it isn't. I actually had a surprising insight from someone who's been looking at the possibility of a DPI program in IMSA, who happens at the moment to be involved with a team that has a current LMP2 car. We had a conversation based on how easy is it to convert one to the other? And the surprising answer that came back was that in this instance, it would be a Dallara becoming effectively a Cadillac DPI, 70% of the cost of the original car, 70% plus, having already got the functional LMP2 car, add another 70% of that cost, and you could have yourself a DPI. And the cost of some of the individual components, pretty terrifying. I'm told, wiring loom, 70,000 euros for a wiring loom for one of those DPIs. So this is not a cheap way to go racing. It may be less expensive than if you chose to go LMP1 hybrid, but that's not to say that the word cheap can actually be applied in any way, shape, or form, because it cannot.
And then you think about the news we discussed last week, Graham, on Tequila Patron announcing their exit from all motorsports sponsorships at the end of the year. And considering that the Extreme Speed team does come out of pocket for everything, Nissan is not spending any dollars with them. It's quite the opposite. They're paying Nissan for their involvement to supply engines and whatnot. There's a definite concern. Might be a little bit strongly worded, but it's one thing to try and do a DPI on a true budget level. What's the least amount that we could acquire a car and then run it for a season? Again, the numbers that I hear bottom would be 4 to 5 million per year. But when you want to not just be there in a DPI, but actually competing for wins, that's where you definitely start to spend many more millions. And so knowing that ESM is going to have to replace Patron to cover not one car but two, and have that funding also go towards ongoing development, it's a big nut, Graham, that they're going to have to acquire to just continue moving forward status quo as they have been. Again, I'm guessing, but we're definitely over 10 million.
I think you're probably about right. And certainly in terms of the conversations that I've been having around privateer LMP1 and the prospect or otherwise of any kind of global formula for that, top end, I'm being told by people that know, should be around 15 there for a 1 to 2 car program. So that would definitely accord. The reality for the IMSA series, by the way, is it isn't cheap. The logistics aren't cheap. And of course, it's a heck of a lot of track time in the 24-hour race, a 12-hour race, and a 10-hour race. So the actual running costs for the cars, you calculate them by the mile or by the lap. It's a very significant portion of the budget.
All right, let's bounce around here a little bit more on the bookie face, and then we will head over to Twitter.
There's an interesting one here from Jordan Hopwood.
That's exactly what I was looking at, so take it.
There you go. Few GT3 cars set to start racing in 2019, including the Porsche, Aston Martin, for that matter, the McLaren, set to debut at Daytona, for the Porsche and Aston Martin at least. These cars won't be able to race at Bathurst because SRO runs that event to the previous year's BOP. Do you think it's dumb cars can race across the world in races like Daytona and Dubai that aren't able to race the opening round of the Intercontinental GT Challenge? Should homologation of new cars be earlier so that isn't a problem? It's because homologation starts from March the 1st. And you're absolutely right that traditionally Daytona and Dubai 24, in IMSA terms and Creventic terms, respectively, will operate a different process so that cars that are not yet homologated are permitted to run. Do I think it's dumb? I don't think it's helpful. I've had multiple conversations with multiple customer racing organizations who would love dearly to bring their latest mega car to Bathurst, and that's not at the moment possible. It does probably, though, help to prop up some of the clubbier end of the grid. Could they change it? Yeah, I think they could. Should they change it? Yeah, I think they probably should. I think the reality is that event is now such a significant event in global terms. If that event is in February, it is. You've got to ask yourself, what is preventing, other than a paperwork change, that change from occurring? Well, I think the answer to that can only come from the FIA. Homologation is an FIA matter. And I'm sure we'll get the normal rapid and reasoned response we get from our friends in Paris.
Yeah, sorry if I had a little button to hit where we had laughter in the background. Got a couple here. Daniel Tripp. Love the podcast. Thank you, Daniel. We do too. What do you think about splitting GT Daytona into Pro-Am and Am-Am subclasses? Might some bronze-rated paying drivers be more interested, knowing that they had an honest-to-goodness chance at a win, albeit a class win? It would certainly address the whole pro and sneaky silver problem. Keep up the good work. I'll tell you, Daniel, if there's one general suggestion that seems to anger the very active and passionate world of sports car fandom, it's, hey, how about we make more classes to follow? So I realize that has nothing to do with the driving side, which was the heart of the question here, but we also have, I think, maybe with the exception of the Pirelli World Challenge Series, which by mandate adds 17 new categories every year, most others I've come across, Graham, are loath to add more. I would say IMSA, in this case, talking about its GT3-based GTD class, very proud, very happy to have cleaved the PC class from the WeatherTech Championship in order to get it down from 4 to 3 categories this year, knowing that there's still talk, and we'll find out, not this weekend, but next, Graham, at Road America IMSA with the state of the series and the announcement of a 2019 schedule and plans and such. We'll find out if they're going to go to that dual P2, spec P2 and DPI classification, where we do have exactly the model you're talking about, Daniel, just in prototypes with the Pro DPI and the Pro-Am points for P2. I don't know if this would ever be something they would consider unless there were at least 10 to 15 gentlemen or gentlewoman drivers wanting a true AM subclass. I mean, part of me says it is the sneaky silver thing. It's funny, I got a text from a GTD owner going into Lime Rock last weekend, just, you know, random, and that's why I love the guy, saying, you know, hey, I think we have a good shot this weekend, but there's some pretty strong fake silvers in the crowd. I would almost rather see the addressing of the fake silver than actually looking to split yet another class to address driver skill imbalances and whatnot. But then again, Daniel, we come back to another kind of old, tried and true aspect of what we talk about each week. Sports car racing is seemingly just built for rules and rules upon rules. So working with driver ratings, applying that to a Pro-Am class, IMSA no longer does its own ratings. It relies on the FIA ratings. There's a lobbying system if someone thinks that they were misclassified. That side's a bit ugly, my friend. But it does just draw me back to, Graham, that I don't think splitting the classes would be the thing. It would just be renewed efforts to say, hey, you're awesome as a driver. There's also no way in the planet Earth you should be a silver. So you're a gold or you're a or higher. I don't know if either one is ever going to realistically happen, though.
Well, I think it's a problem that the world of motorsport created for itself, and it's done it so for good reasons. It did so in the first instance to effectively prop up Pro-Am, because people recognised that, you know, that effectively is where you're getting the the spine, if you like, of the grids for the major international championships all around the world, and give these guys something that they can win. That is a problem for some purists. The reality is that these are the guys who are de facto employing a goodly proportion of the people in that paddock. Therefore, there is a good argument to say that that needs to be recognised commercially, in terms of, you know, you come in, you're making that contribution, let's give you something that you can actually go and compete for. The problem comes in, of course, with driver ratings. I've long said it before on this podcast. I think we're at the stage where that needs to be looked at again, and I don't mean that needs to be revised. I think we need to take 2, 3, 4 steps away from it and say, does this actually make sense anymore? In very many cases, it doesn't. We're now getting sets of organizing bodies putting in their own systems, subsets of those, and now most recently, and particularly in the ACO's world, promoter decisions made as to whether or not the FIA's decisions are going to be fully respected for that race or those championships. I think we're a long way away now from the original intention of that system, and I think that system needs to be thoroughly reviewed, deconstructed and started again, not put another layer on top of it. That would be the wrong way to go. Take a step away, look at what the driver rankings are meant to achieve, ask yourself the question, is it achieving that, or is it now creating more problems for race organisers and teams than it's actually solving? I happen to think that that's the case.
We are fortunate in sports car racing, Graham, to have decades upon decades of amazing history, and also during this long time span, a lot of vehicles with amazing liveries. So it's not a surprise that almost on a weekly basis we get some sort of livery-based question, which I love because it forces you and I to think beyond the "we like the martini" livery, which is go-to throughout the world. So this one comes in from Buddy Campbell. So sponsors like STP, Coke, Marlboro, Budweiser, etc. have been on multiple race cars, bikes, boats, planes over the years. Which sponsor overall through the years do you think has had the best-looking liveries?
Can I have a first crack at this?
Please.
I'll give you a couple. There's so many. Jägermeister is always a big favourite of mine. BASF has been another one that's just had some epic liveries. You do tend to come down, though, to the ones that have been around for a long time. And for me, there are two that when I see them, it just, there's something about those liveries. Golf, yes. And happily in all sorts of different Pantones. Not famously, but notoriously, my office back at home, I have what is known as the Window Ledge Collection. They're basically Hot Wheels size cars. And I only collect cars of that size, which will fit on the window ledge. Mm. And some of them are pure race replicas. So some of the big kind of name diecast makers, some of them are Hot Wheels. And I do have a little Golf sub collection of those. Golf and the other one, not that popular in this day and age with changes in sensibilities and legalities, but John Player Special. It was the car that got me into it. What got me into motorsports properly to start with was my beloved grandmother handing to me a Corgi, UK yes. make for diecast Corgi
a
model.
Small metal dog. Small metal.
Absolutely. Yeah. Lotus 72. That, for me, started it all. And that, to me, is still a livery that today puts a smile on my face. They're the two for me.
So I think in past examples of this question, I have mentioned the green tone-on-tone and white Jaguar XJR 5 and 7s that ran in the IMSA GTP category. I believe I have mentioned the silk cut, the tone-on-tone purple with the silk cut Jags, most notably probably the XJR 14 from Group C / World Sports Prototype Championship. And I think there might have been one or two others that have meant Löwenbräu, the Al Holbert Löwenbräu sponsored Porsche 962s. I'm going to jump, since Buddy, you just mentioned all disciplines. I'll mention another one that while it isn't sports car, it is just truly stunning in the few different examples, and that would be Pennzoil's IndyCar liveries. The yellow submarine, Indy 500 winning yellow submarine, Chaparral 2K comes to mind. But even this year, in the year before, and they've done it a couple times with Elio Castroneves' Indy 500 entry in that yellow submarine Pennzoil motif. Oh, just wow. Cars that stand out from all the others, even back in the 90s when Pennzoil came back and was sponsoring Jim Hall's cars, from John Andretti in 91 up through Gilles DeFerrin when he was with the team. Just some gorgeous, gorgeous Pennzoil yellow liveries that really stand out to me that I don't think I have mentioned before as a favorite. And this one happens to be open wheel, so please, please forgive me. Graham, I'm going to grab one more here from Facebook, and then why don't you take the next. And this also comes in from Jordan Hopwood and got a whole bunch of likes from folks. So it's with the World Cup finishing last week. It got me thinking, I already know that Le Mans is the greatest motor race in the world, but if there is a World Cup from motorsports that only happened every 4 years, what do you guys think it would look like? What types of cars would it run? Who would the participants be, drivers versus drivers, or manufacturer versus manufacturer? What track should it be on? What qualification process should be used for the global event? Also, what should the prize be? So we've got about five or six things here to look after, starting with what it should look like. And I assume that might be, let's look at cars and tracks to consider for a World Cup. First of all, who could we get to pay us $11 billion to host it?
Well, I mean, here's the odd thing, MP, is it wouldn't be, for me, the World Cup. There's lots of Nations Cups and there's the Race of Champions and blah, blah, blah. And that's all very nice, but pretty entertainment-led. The other one that does come up, by the way, is motorsports at the Olympic Games. And there's absolutely no reason why that should not happen. In fact, it did happen in 1900. I think it was, is it Paris 1900? But certainly it has happened before. If you can have equestrian sport in the Olympic Games, there is no reason at all why you shouldn't have motorsports in the Olympic Games. If we were going to do something to a World Cup format, I think you would have to have something that is fairly multidisciplinary. So in other words, you know, for very many people, amongst the best drivers in the world are rally drivers. So therefore, you'd have to have a discipline that played to their strengths as well as a circuit racing discipline. So for me, if you were going to do it, the sensible way to do it would be multiple different tracks with drivers from across the world of motorsports and in multiple different, and it would have to be one make cars because it would have to be a driver's championship. Would there be an oval race? Probably. Would there be some kind of rally stage? I think definitely. Would there have to be some kind of iconic road course? Certainly. I see no reason why you shouldn't have a crack at it. The problem is that the motorsport schedules now are so interwoven that it would be nigh on impossible for a multi-disciplinary, multi-event concept to actually get off the ground. And there's so many inherent interests with the worlds of IndyCar, NASCAR, Formula One, that you can just see, can't you, the number of hurdles to try to get in the way of that being something that would stifle it before it even started. Would I like to see it? Of course I'd like to see it. Who wouldn't like a fundamental answer to the question, who is currently the best driver in the world? Is it Jordan Taylor or is it Lewis Hamilton or is it Evan Risley?
Definitely Evan Riersley. What I like about this question, Graham, and thank you for submitting it, Jordan, is it makes me think about the choice of tracks, I should say, to add to this. For me, at least, I'm thinking outside of an Olympic scenario, but more one of maybe something where we discussed, I don't know, a month or however long ago, about wouldn't it be great to have the land speed record or time record championship where Pikes Peak and Bonneville and all kinds of just one vehicle not competing against others, but, you know, trying to break time or speed barriers. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing to have? I like the idea of this, Jordan, but from one where it was inclusive with some sort of major iconic oval, a Pike's Peak, a truly daunting road course, something like Mount Panorama. Again, maybe pick 4 to 5 tracks throughout the world that are just truly 100% unique, and use that as the collection. But then I would say, since some form of spec-ish type rules would be required, or at least folks building to one specification, I like the idea of having some limitations on that, which is weird for me to say because I'm always the guy saying the opposite, get rid of the rules. But what I would like to see is something where, with this multi-discipline thing, a drag race as well, like just truly, you know, your fastest quarter mile. So just pull in these crazy things where we have, in theory, every type of discipline of motor racing, but then ask folks, whether it's manufacturers, privateers, whatever, to build to a common set of rules, not spec cars, but a common set that's fairly tightly defined so that we do not have the drag race special that is just purely stripped down and just made 100% for the drag strip and then converted to be 100% for Bathurst, 100% for an oval. Something where manufacturers and entrants would have to decide, okay, I have a bunch of tracks that I'm going to, a hill climb, an oval, drag race, road course, the street course. These are so vastly different. I'm going to have to pick and choose which ones in my build philosophy that we would have a stronger chance of winning, knowing that I'm probably going to have to suffer at a few others. Because there's no way you're going to build a car, build something aerodynamically, mechanically, that is going to be perfect on the streets of Monaco or Long Beach, and then absolutely sing around Indianapolis Motor Speedway. There are going to be compromises. Which concessions are you going to make? Which races would you effectively give up, knowing that you might lose them, but you are placing a heavy emphasis on succeeding at the vast majority of some others? So that is where I think the challenge would be really fun to see. It would also probably make Formula One budget look small, having to do that. But while we're playing with other people's money in a fantasy world that doesn't exist, Jordan, that's okay by me.
Right, I think down to me to...
It's up to you.
Yeah, one more from me.
Yes.
Because we're beginning to wind this up, aren't we? I'm going to go with Nathan Barnes. Nathan, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Having just learned about Pittsburgh International Race Complex a few weeks ago and the upcoming Trans Am race there, despite growing up less than 2 hours from it, what hidden gem racetrack do you think would be a good stop for a sports car series of your choice and why? Great question. In the UK, we are blessed with a pretty large number for our small population and small footprint on the planet, pretty large number of very good racetracks indeed, several of which I've been lucky enough to visit and report upon happenings there, but several of which also don't really have properly top-end mainstream events for all sorts of reasons, one of which is that they're not that large, the safety standards may not be up to what is required. But either way, I'm going to name two of them. One of them is a place called Cadwell Park up in Lincolnshire. And now Cadwell Park is a magnificent place. It is like a mini Nürburgring. I've been chauffeured around there. I've nearly killed race drivers by chauffeuring them around there. I have been on one of the most awesome laps of my still relatively young life at the hands of one Mr. Johnny Cocker in a Radical SR8. The lap in any race car, I can tell you right now, that absolutely redefined what this is all about for me. I don't scare in a race car at all, which is a good reason why you don't put me in the driving seat of one. I love sitting next to these guys when, you know, they really know what they're doing at the top of their game. And Johnny Cocker put together a lap, despite the not inconsiderable frame of Mr. Goodwin next to him, that would have put him on the second row of the grid for the Masters, the European Masters championship for those radical cars. That is a fabulous little track. It's really technical corners, properly quick, and across what's called the mountain section, daunting stuff as well. Great bike circuit. That's one. The other one is Anglesey Circuit. Anglesey, very close to where my father was brought up after being evacuated from Guernsey as the Germans invaded in the Second World War. And the reason for Anglesey, it's not because it's one of the best circuits, it's because it's one of the most stunning settings, with the Irish Sea literally just out the back of the circuit, which can produce all sorts of weather, but a massively dramatic setting for a race. And was lucky enough to go and commentate there 2 years on the trot for a thing called the Race of Remembrance, which was put together by Mission Motorsport, a charity in the UK, has an affiliated charity over there in North America, MP, where they get injured ex-servicemen and women back into work, and they use motorsport as an engine to do that. And on two occasions that I've been party to, we've been out there in the wintry weather at Anglesey with a backdrop of the Irish Sea. It's a mega place to go motor racing. They're the two for me.
Well, we're going to stick with those two for you, and I'm going to grab a couple more on the book faces, and then maybe one more on Twitter, and we will bid farewell to this episode. Let's see. All right, well, here's one that's a little bit topical as well. Steve Smith Jr., our friend Steve Smith and his son, says, "Hey, guys, so Dave and I want to know, how can we bribe you two into doing a live podcast from Daytona next year? A little birdie tells me the Wayne Taylor team is getting hooked up with the world's best barbecue. I'm sure they won't mind sharing. Come on, make it happen. You know you want to." Funny you should mention that, Steve. So I'm doing the second ever Marshall Pruitt Podcast live event this weekend at Mid-Ohio on Friday at the IndyCar event. The following weekend, we're doing the third ever. We're using the Weekend IndyCar and Weekend Sports Cars model of having guests, either us talking or those who phone in, posing some questions to them, and then essentially handing the mic to the crowd, in this case, those of you who kindly write in, and let you ask questions of our guests. So while Graham won't be with me in Road America for IMSA, right now we have Elio Castroneves, Christina Nielsen, and I'm not sure who the third is going to be, either someone from Corvette Racing, or if not, I'll ask Bobby Rahal, a former overall winner there in IMSA in the 1980s, to join us. And with that said, I'm looking at the rest of my schedule just this year, and I know you're asking about next year, Steve. I'll get to that in just a second, but I'm looking at the rest of the year, and I believe I'll be doing another one IndyCar-wise at Portland. I believe we'll be doing one at the Monterey IMSA round. Again, IndyCar with Sonoma after that. And then I've had a manufacturer ask us to do one at Petit Le Mans with them, Graham. So I think, and based on some conversations I've had regarding next year already on the IMSA side, I think you could very well, Steve, see little yappity flappity heads like mine and Graham Goodwin hosting just these kind of live half hour, maybe an hour if we can find time, these live podcasts. And, you know, I mean, we call them podcasts. What are they? It's just hopefully a fun Q&A session with some drivers or engineers, team owners, and whatnot. And you know, obviously, as fans, we can go to various events and they have the autograph signings and you can get something signed with a driver and maybe pose for a photo, but that's about it. We just try and do something a little bit different here to make these folks readily available, where you can not only ask questions with them, but hang out afterwards, talk a bit, get some more stuff signed, take some selfies, whatever, whatever. Just trying to, you know, bridge that gap between what we do on the media side. And I don't even really consider this media with our podcast, Graham. It's just you and I talking about stuff we love, and bringing everyone else who happens to love, whether it's open wheel or sports car racing, a little bit closer to some of those who make it happen. So I think Daytona will be pretty much a guarantee, along with Sebring, Long Beach. And, you know, this is something that I am at least anticipating, Steve, having to schedule into most weekends. And even just this weekend, I'll mention quickly, Graham, folks at Mid-Ohio said, this would be great. Let's do it. And I said, all right, cool. Well, how would you want to do it? And found out yesterday that they're renting a full dedicated sound system. They're setting out.
Oh, wow.
They're setting out, you know, chairs and tables and this and that. There's going to be some fun giveaways going on. Our friends at Toronto Motorsports, who we now have, by the way, they're not for sale yet, but because we have to run some more. But there are now some Week in IndyCar t-shirts and some Week in Sports Cars t-shirts with our mugs on them using the little cartoons. That we'll be giving away some of those at Mid-Ohio and at Road America, Graham. And, I don't know, man. I mean, at this point in time in my life, in this stage of my career, I've been working in motor racing since I was 16. I'm 47 now, I think. And I'm just trying to have fun. I'm just trying to have fun. I don't have much of a point to prove anymore.
This is fun. This is fun.
It is.
This is fun.
We do we do. We show up, have fun, enjoy talking with whomever. Again, there's no point to prove. We're established in the industry doing whatever it is that we do. So that's all great. This is truly just like, hey, what are some new fun things we can do? And if these live podcasts are it, then we're going to put on as many as we can, Steve. The real question, though, is how often can we have our co-pilot, Mr. Goodwin, on the ground to co-host? So hopefully that'll be part of the fun next year too, because we're making millions here. I mean, we have told you about the G5 jet, the Week in Sports Cars podcast G5 jet that we fly around on. So there's no reason, Graham.
I had to actually. The honest answer is, it's lucky actually we didn't connect a little earlier. I did have to get the pilot to shut down the executive Chinook that's in the little field next to me. Just ferries me between appointments nowadays. But look, I love it. I mean, there's anybody that's met me in a paddock will know that I will always, if I've ever got the possibility of doing it, stop and chew the fat about racing at any stage, any point whatsoever. So to have one of my pals ring me up on a regular basis and say, hey, can we chat about sports cars for an hour and a half? I'll switch the mic on. Not a problem. Love it to bits. And yes, very firmly part of it. My brain is ticking away about things we can do on my side too. So watch for a bit more of that.
Oh, look at that. Okay, I'm going to grab one or two more and then let's go ahead and say goodbye. And I'll just say quickly to Johnny Thompson, thank you for sending in the short story that also doubled as a question/comment. And we will probably try and park. No, and I'm not. I mean, this is awesome. I'm just unfortunate I'm getting to it a little late when we're both having to go. But maybe we can get into that next week. I'll grab one here from Shay Martin Small, who I assume one of us referred to as a she in a previous question, because Shay's final note is also, I'm a guy, not a chick. So apologies, Shay. We might have lumped you in with Shay Adam and somehow got something wrong. Shay Adam definitely being a chick and not a guy, to use your parlance there.
I've just checked the pictures on his Facebook page. We're both in real trouble if he's taking offense.
Definitely sorry. Tell us where to send money, whatever it takes to not get clobbered. We certainly apologize, Shay. Says, hey, MP and GG, keep up the great work with the podcast, other than obviously getting genders wrong. With the near on weekly rumors of Brendan Hartley, and let's make this the last question here. Nigh on weekly rumors of Brendan Hartley being dropped from F1, where do you think would be a great next step for him? Where do you think he would want to end up? I'd like to add that I hope he doesn't get dropped and continues on living with the dream. I mean, if Peter Barron were to start up a prototype team again, that would kind of be a no-brainer there, since that's where really he came to prominence in those kinds of cars.
I think the answer is that there will be an orderly queue for Mr. Hartley's services. It has been one of the epically poor years in Formula One for any driver, and an awful lot of it not to be laid at his door. But these things happen. If it is the case that Brendan is not part of the plan for next season, and good to see, by the way, him getting a point at the weekend just gone, then I think he'll have a not-so-short list of options to take. I hope so. A very excellent young man, and mighty, mighty quick. I don't think it'll be too long before, whether or not he's still in Formula One, we see him back in a sports car at Le Mans too.
Amen to that. All right. Well, I'm Marshall Pruitt. That is Graham Goodwin. This is your Week in Sports Cars episode. Thank you to Cooper Tires for their ongoing support and patronage. And also thank you to our friends at the Justice Brothers and JusticeBrothers.com for their specific support here during the month of July. And Graham, next week I will probably be calling you from either something in the John Doonan office or Bobby Ray Hall man cave to record what is Ooh. Going down. So enjoy the rest of the vacation with the missus, and we'll look forward to speaking to you next week.